Coming up on Fronteras, the number of U.S. Border Patrol agents has been growing rapidly, and not just along the southern border.
Obviously, on the southern border with Mexico, there's significantly more Border Patrol, but the rate of growth on the northern border has been higher in the post-9/11 era than on the southern border.
The Border Patrol's expanding reach and the implications for privacy rights, civil liberties, and more. We speak to Todd Miller, author of the new book, Border Patrol Nation, on Fronteras. Also, on a lighter note, taking pictures in a field of bluebonnets, that's a favorite tradition in Texas this time of year.
Ladies, do we have the most beautiful bluebonnets in the state?
Yes!
One town in particular is especially serious about its bluebonnets. Those stories, but first, the news. Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. The president of the University of Texas at Austin is weighing in on the U.S. Supreme Court decision that upheld the state of Michigan's ban on affirmative action in higher education. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Papia reports UT President Bill Powers calls the decision a real setback for diversity.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the state of Michigan's decision that bans colleges and universities from using any type of affirmative action for admissions. The University of Texas at Austin itself is in the middle of its own affirmative action federal challenge brought forth by Abigail Fisher, who is white and was turned down for admissions at UT. The school's president, Bill Powers.
It is critical to give opportunity to all groups in our state and our country. But it's equally critical to make sure that that educational experience has to be on a diverse campus. And not just a diverse campus, but in diverse individual classrooms.
Powers says diversity isn't simply defined by race.
Well, I define diversity in a number of ways: cultural, economic, points of view from religious to political, and ethnic and racial diversity. That's one important component.
Powers also says in order for colleges and universities to achieve diversity, there must first be a huge outreach effort that informs all these groups of students about the opportunities that lie ahead. The U.S. Supreme Court sent the Fisher case back to the Fifth Circuit Court, calling for more evidence from both sides of the affirmative action argument. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
In Garland, 24 teachers are still in limbo. Recruited from other countries, they're on the verge of losing their jobs and being deported. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, school systems and teachers across the country and in Dallas are dealing with similar visa problems.
In Maryland, the U.S. Labor Department fined one school district nearly $2 million and ordered it to pay $4 million in back wages. In Louisiana, 350 Filipino teachers won a class action lawsuit against a recruiting company that forced them to sign away 10% of their salaries. And in Garland, federal agencies are looking into the foreign teacher recruitment and employment practices of the district and its former human resources director.
It's a racket, you know. We're going to go out and find you people, you know, that will meet your needs because you can't find qualified teachers here in America. And I just think that it's a scheme and it's a way to abuse people. And it's shameful the way people get treated.
That's Linda Bridges, president of the American Federation of Teachers in Austin, who's critical of abuses by companies or school districts that have hired foreign teachers. Several years ago, her organization sued a company that recruited Indian teachers to North Forest ISD, a district recently absorbed by the Houston School District after years of financial mismanagement. She also recalls a group of Indian teachers who fell victim in Corpus Christi several years ago.
You know, put them, almost all of them, up in like one apartment, no furniture. They had no transportation. Other teachers would pick them up, take them to work, and took care of them, you know, got them established.
In Garland, the problems span a 10-year period during which 600-plus foreign teachers were hired. They include all-expenses-paid recruiting trips by the HR director and allegations that fees were pocketed from the teachers. And in Dallas, 79 foreign teachers are unsure whether they'll get to keep their jobs or have to return to their native countries. Their visas are set to expire soon, and they either haven't been granted extensions to stay or gotten their green cards. The district says the U.S. Labor Department keeps rejecting its applications to certify the teachers' employment.
One of the requirements when they came into the district was that they had to complete their certification within a year in order for the process to begin. Well, some of these teachers have been here 6 years now.
George Rangel is executive vice president of Alliance AFT in Dallas. He says in some cases, the paperwork has sat on someone's desk too long or not been filed correctly. They contain errors like transposed social security numbers, misspelled names, and other discrepancies.
If truly the district was serious about taking care of these teachers, one, they would mandate the department make sure that whatever paperwork goes out of there is correct and has double-checked. And that's not happening.
Spokesman John DeLander says the district isn't going to point fingers at anyone.
For starters, we're going to stand by every one of these teachers and continue to file appeals on their behalf with the Department of Labor because they're valuable to us and we want to do everything we can to keep them.
DeLander says the district's filed more than 200 appeals since 2012. Each year, Congress limits the number of H-1B visas that can be issued. This year, the cap's at 85,000. Doug Stump, president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, says applications are surging well past that.
For example, this year, you know, during that first week period that they would accept the applications, there were over 175,000 H-1B visa petitions filed for these 85,000 positions.
Stump says teacher shortages in some areas, like math and science, are prompting districts to seek teachers on H-1B visas. In Dallas, DeLander says the greatest need is for bilingual teachers.
When you have a student population that is about a third of which come from homes where only Spanish is spoken, then that presents some unique challenges. And part of that is going the extra mile to keep our teachers that are on H-1B visas.
Things have gotten so complicated that some districts are turning away from hiring teachers with H-1B visas. In Houston, those teachers can still apply, but the district isn't actively recruiting them. And Dallas isn't planning to sponsor any new teachers with H-1B visas next school year. Stella Chavez, KERA News.
The U.S. Border Patrol's growing quickly in the number of agents and resources it has, including high-end surveillance technology. In his new book, Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Frontlines of Homeland Security, Todd Miller makes the case that the entire country is in effect transforming into one vast militarized border zone. I spoke to Miller this week about his research for the book.
Border Patrol Nation is looking primarily at the post-9/11 expansion of the Border Patrol, but in looking at it from many different angles and many different facets. It looks at the money behind it. Not only the expanse of agents, which there's been a huge expanse of agents, not only on the southern border, but on the northern border, and actually in the Caribbean as well, but also the expansion of money and resources and the connection between the private industry and the Department of Homeland Security and our border security agencies.
Give us an idea of just how fast the Border Patrol is growing.
It's growing really fast. If you think about it, Border Patrol was started in 1924, and it started with approximately 1,000 agents. Up until 1990, Border Patrol had about 4,000 agents, so it grew from 1,000 to 4,000. Now there are almost 22,000 agents. So it is five times. It's growing at the fastest rate it's ever grown in the history of the agency. It's also under now the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection. Customs and Border Protection is 60,000 agents. And if you think about that, that number is significant because it's double the size of Ecuador's army.
When people think about Border Patrol, they often think about the border with Mexico. But in your book, you talk a lot about the growing presence of Border Patrol along the Canadian border. Talk about that.
That is one of the. It's actually, if you look at the rates of growth, obviously on the southern border with Mexico, there's significantly more Border Patrol, but the rate of growth on the northern border has been higher in the post 9/11 era than on the southern border. So it is significant. While For example, in Detroit, it's gone from 40 to 400 agents. In Buffalo, it's gone from 30 to about 300. So we're looking at a significant growth rate on the U.S.-Canada border, with increasing technologies as well, such as the surveillance towers we see in the south are now along. There's 11 of them along the St. Clair River between Michigan and Ontario, for example.
One of the feelings one gets reading this book is that mass surveillance and this whole Big Brother idea of constantly being watched. And is there a quick story you can tell us about how this growing Border Patrol nation, as you put it, affects ordinary American citizens that may not live on the border?
Right. There's a story of, I document the story in the book. It's a French American who named Pascal Abidor. He goes to a school in McGill University in Montreal. One time he was crossing the border to go to visit his parents in New York City. And when he got to the border crossing, agents from CBP looked at his laptop and saw he's an Islamic studies major. They saw that he had pictures from a Hezbollah rally that he witnessed when he was in Lebanon, I believe. Because of that picture, he was taken off the train, so he missed the train to go to New York City. Then he was detained for approximately 5 hours in a small cell. He was interrogated about what he was doing. He had to keep repeating that he was an Islamic studies major. He was studying the Shiites. He was a PhD student. Finally, they let him go, but they kept his laptop. 10 days later, he gets his laptop, but it's quite apparent that agents have gone through his laptop, including all kinds of personal information that he's had in his laptop, including conversations with his girlfriend, stuff like that. This is one of more than 6,000 incidents of people's electronic devices being taken from them at border crossings, which actually the ACLU had a lawsuit about this, and that was through a 2-year span. So that's one example of many of this kind of surveillance apparatus aspect to this.
Now, I can hear people saying, but don't we need this kind of surveillance to protect against potential terroristic threats?
So we have all these resources, and we're talking billions and billions of dollars of resources that are going into this, not any evidence that they're catching terrorists, while we're cutting budgets for other basic services and other critical sectors of the basic needs that people have, such as housing and education and health.
One of the other places where you say the Border Patrol presence is growing is on native lands, and how does that work with tribes who have their own laws and rules on sovereign land?
Yeah, I document the Tonalatam Nation on southern Arizona, and it's actually a highly qualified sense of sovereignty, in the sense that one, it's a indigenous nation where the Tonalatam make their own laws, and the Tonalatam land, traditionally their aboriginal land, extends deep. It goes from about Phoenix, where Phoenix is, deep into Mexico, about 200 miles to the south of the border. So when the borderline was drawn, and actually back in 1853, it cut right through the center of their land. But there was no real Border Patrol presence on the Altam Reservation until the post 9/11 era. And what you see is a lot of collaboration between the Tonalatam Legislative Council and Border Patrol, but you see a lot of increasing criticism of the actions of Border Patrol on the Tonalatam Nation. And when pushed, officials or an official, for example, Border Patrol official, which I document in the book, admitted to one of the tribal members of the Tonalatam Nation that it doesn't even matter what you think. We're the federal law or the federal mission trumps whatever sovereignty the Tonalatam Nation has. So Border Patrol can go on the nation whether they agree to it or not.
Where do you see things going in the future, especially with talks about immigration reform?
So if we're going to look gauge, how things are going via immigration reform, from what I look at, for example, there's a Senate bill passed in June of last year. It was about 1,000 pages long, so it has a lot of different things in it. But one of the big elements of that immigration reform bill passed by the Senate was that it had about a big section on border security. In fact, in that one, it was $46 billion. And part of that $46 billion was increasing the Border Patrol's forces by 19,000 agents. And that would increase it from 21,000 to 40,000. And what they said, they'd have agents every 1,000 feet along the entire 2,000-mile Mexico, U.S.-Mexico border. And there was a lot of money put into technologies, including doubling. Right now there's a drone fleet of about 10 primarily Predator B drones that are being used to surveil the borderlands. With that immigration reform bill, it would be increased to 24. So when we're looking at immigration reform right now, one huge element is actually, it seems to be in all the bills, this idea of continuing to up-armor our borders. And the question I would raise with that is that, you know, when you think about all the elements of immigration reform, including like this idea of legalization and approximately 11.5 undocumented people that live in the country, do they have to always be in the same bill? It seems like that's the way it's going.
Todd Miller is author of Border Patrol Nation: Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. Snapping photos in a field of bluebonnets, that's a favorite springtime tradition in Texas.
Ladies, do we have the most beautiful bluebonnets in the state?
Yes!
But one town in particular is especially proud of its bluebonnets. That story here on Fronteras after the break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. It's an iconic springtime image in Texas, snapping family photos in a field of bluebonnets. And Ennis is Bluebonnet Central. Every April, up to 100,000 people flock to the Ellis County town, about 45 minutes south of Dallas. It's home to 40 miles of roadsides covered with wildflowers. KERA's Eric Austin headed to the official Bluebonnet City of Texas to find out what the state flower means to Ennis.
It's 9:30 in the morning, the sun is bright, and about two dozen ladies from the Ennis Garden Club have hopped on a bus.
Good morning and welcome.
They're taking a tour of miles and miles of bluebonnet fields. These flower detectives are on a mission: spot as many blooms as possible.
Oh my gosh, look in the distance. Look straight ahead, up on the hill. Straight ahead through the trees.
The gently rolling hills are covered with thousands of budding bluebonnets, but they won't peak until Easter weekend. Nearby are longhorn cattle, horses, fences, hay bales, and ponds. Can it get any more Texas than this?
Look here on the right. Another little patch.
Sandy Anderson is leading the scouting trip. She's chairwoman of the Ennis Garden Club. Since 1951, the group has provided the flower power for the month-long Ennis Bluebonnet Trails. They drive the roads, scouting the best sites. They update maps and pass along tips to visitors. Naturally, Anderson can't get enough of the state flower.
I told my family the other day, I want to be buried in the bluebonnets, I want a bench beside my stone, and I want there to be a sign that says, don't mow.
Anderson declares the Ennis bluebonnets are the best in Texas. But of course she'd say that, right?
I may be biased, but it's the truth.
Ladies, do we have the most beautiful bluebonnets in the state?
Yes!
The Ennis gardening grandmas take a break for lunch.
Okay, I think we're going to stop right here and let everybody off the bus.
Keep driving north on the bluebonnet trails and into the town of Palmer. There you'll find a big blue house with a huge field. This is where Doug Dickinson lives. Folks call him the Bluebonnet Man. He opens his front yard to thousands of tourists.
Makes me feel good. And to think that I am doing, I think, what the good Lord wants me to do is to share what I have with other people.
Visitors send him tokens of appreciation, a bottle of wine, pictures, and emails like this one.
You're a blessed man, as you allow us to share the beauty of God's creation on your property.
Notes like that keep him going.
You know, I'm 77 years old, and the good Lord has kept me here through three heart surgeries, staph infection, an aneurysm that almost killed me, and I said, there's got to be a reason.
Stop along the bluebonnet trails, and you'll run into hordes of families snapping photos in the flowers. There's one family with four generations. Jim Terry has brought his wife Rosa, who's holding their great-grandson, Ryan Oliver, who's 19 months old.
Say pretty.
See?
Pretty flower.
Along with them are Laura Oliver with her 7-year-old niece, Natalie Ball.
They're blue, and they smell good. They kind of smell like lavender.
The winds are strong, and the kids' attention spans are short, but they're going to do whatever it takes to get the perfect picture.
There you go. Put those boots up. Show me your boots. There you go.
And don't leave Natalie's special friend out of the shot, Sage, her American Girl doll.
Because she has a cowgirl dress and cowgirl boots, and she has a horse.
For Natalie's aunt Laura, the Ennis Bluebonnet Fields are a rite of spring.
Getting away from the city, getting away from everyday responsibilities and challenges, and just spending time together in a beautiful location.
It's not just about getting the perfect picture. It's about getting memories as vivid as the bluebonnets themselves. Eric Austin, KERA News.
Those Texas bluebonnets, how sweetly they grow. O'er all the white prairies, they're scattered like snow. They make all the meadows as blue as the skies, reminding me of my little darling's blue eyes. I wanted to ramble, so I started to roam. And I didn't think twice about leaving my home. But when I got to Texas, not far from Burnett, let me forget. Those Texas bluebonnets, how sweetly they grow. O'er all the white prairies, they're scattered like snow. They make all the meadows.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thank you for listening.